Thanks everyone for coming along to this session by Zach Roberts on SPICE, Structured Products to Improve Capital Efficiency. Zach's got a medium length pack. It certainly won't take up the whole session to go through the pack. So feel free to sort of ask questions as you go along. Zach's very interested in feedback from the audience. Certainly if you disagree with anything that's up there or think something isn't going to work, don't sit quiet, stick your hand up and get the discussion going. I've got a little bio somewhere here on Zach, which I will read out. It's interesting. After surviving 5 years at the mercy of the Japanese university education system, Zach Roberts worked as a consulting actuary with Tillinghast for 8 years. At Tillinghast, Zach worked with wealth management companies in Australia, Japan and other parts of Asia. He then joined Deutsche Bank in July 2007 and focuses on delivering alternative and structured assets to insurers to help them meet their return objectives within internal company risk management guidelines and regulatory constraints. Hence, products to improve capital efficiency. Just in terms of sort of questions and discussions, there is a sort of roving mic up there on a chair next to the projector. So if you do want to ask a question, please just grab the mic and use that. So now I'll hand over to Zach.
Okay. Thanks, Anton. What I'm sort of mainly going to go through today is just a few examples that have come up in the way, as examples of the way we look at investments within the actual constraints imposed by the regulations and also internal capital requirements. So by no means is this an exhaustive list of what is possible. It's really, as Anton said, just put up there for the purposes of getting discussion going, getting people thinking about these types of things. And, there will be some things which are potentially controversial, so we'll see what happens. So after just giving an overview of the various risk management approaches that are available, I'm then going to go into three specific examples around actually improving capital efficiency, one being using interest rate derivatives, the second one looking at structured equities, and the third one looking at alternative assets. And we'll touch on both the capital efficiency for life insurers and general insurers as well for some of this. That's all sort of looking at the assets or, the asset side of things, or in the derivative one, using derivative as an asset to hedge the liabilities. We'll then have a brief look at the financing side and how different ideas that can be used to decrease the cost of capital on the financing side, as opposed to where the other idea is more about decreasing the required amount of capital. And then sort of a follow-on from the way I think you should therefore look at the strategic asset allocation process. I sort of put this list together just as a way of, okay, well, how do we manage risk? The first one, can't be relied upon by insurers because they're in the business of taking on risk. But Australian insurers have been particularly good at taking on as little risk as they possibly can. So I suppose they've been using that one as well. Once you have risk, then obviously you hold capital, transfer it to policyholders. Obviously that happens a lot in Australia with the investment risk. Or reinsurers or transferring to capital markets, there's no sort of right answer for all occasions. It really depends on what's the risk. Some risks a reinsurer will give a better price than capital markets. Some risks capital markets will give a better price. Some risks you'll decide both of them are too expensive and we're just going to hold capital. But it's quite important, I think, to actually explore what's out there first. So moving on to our first example of interest rate risk. Set up the assumption here that you've got a book of long-term liabilities. Maybe, for example, you've got an annuity portfolio, which for some reason or other isn't matched by sort of duration matched fixed income. So therefore, the equivalent you've got is short bonds. You're exposed to falls in interest rates, because the value of your liabilities will increase more than the value of your assets. You have to hold capital against that under the resilience reserve, for example. But the question is that your cost of capital, you have a constant rate for your cost of capital. But if you were to actually go out to capital markets and purchase protection against falls in interest rates, the cost of protection decreases the further away from at the money you get. So it's worth exploring whether there is a sort of crossover point at which it becomes cheaper to purchase protection than actually to hold capital against interest rate falls. Which is what I've done on this page. So if we just consider, for example, as a sort of rough measure that you've got $100 million worth of this sort of mismatch position, and let's say that the resilience reserve requires you to test what happens with a 2% interest rate fall. Okay. What I've examined here is, let's say you do hold capital for the first 1% fall, but then look at hedging away the risk from below a 1% fall. So falls of more than 1% in interest rates. One way of doing that is through an interest rate option where every quarter, we'll put it this way, it's 1% out of the money to start with, but then every quarter, if interest rates do rise, the strike price of the option also rises, so it stays 1% out of the money. The need to do that was driven by the need of the requirements that there's no point having a hedge which protects you against a 1% fall in rates now, but in 3 months' time it's only protecting you against a 1.5% fall in rates. So it was to keep the protection over time, sort of at sort of quarterly valuation dates, at sort of a 1% fall in rates. Again, a one-year option isn't that useful for the standards because you have to be able to withstand a fall in rates over a one-year period.
Fantastic.
Over a one-year period. So if you have a one-year option, a day into it, then it's not giving you the protection you need for the regulations anymore. Because if that rate fall was to happen in the last day in the year, you're not covered anymore. So we've found that what you really need is a two-year option, which in 1 year's time, you sell and roll into a new two-year option, so that you've always got at least 1 year's worth of protection. If markets don't change over that year, the net cost of buying that two-year option and in 1 year's time selling it again is about $500,000. Obviously, it'll depend on the interest rate environment at the time. If you look at $500,000, if you didn't have protection, you would be holding $7.5 million as capital. Then $500,000 equates to about a 7% cost of capital. So it appears that if your internal cost of capital is more than 7%, and I mean net cost there, so 7% above risk-free, if your internal cost of capital is more than 7%, then under this example, it would be a more efficient approach to, instead of holding capital for that part of the interest rate fall, to actually hedge that in the markets. It actually comes along with the other benefit that if such a big fall does happen, if you hold capital, all you've done is lost your capital. If you actually have protection, you have an asset which pays off an amount to offset that fall, and you haven't eaten through your capital. Okay. I might just see if there's any questions on that particular example before I move on to the next one. The next one I'm going to give an example of is structured equity. And I'm not sort of thinking here in terms of structured equity instead of unprotected equity, because it's more structured equity as a way of trying to achieve a small earning above risk-free, or sometimes a larger earning above risk-free rates, depending on how it is, in a capital-efficient manner. Okay. So we've got one example here. Let me just see what I've got. Of a particular two-year note. So no coupons along the way, just a payoff at the end of 2 years. You've got a 95% capital guarantee in 2 years' time. And then in 2 years' time, you calculate what's been the performance of the underlying equities. In this example, we've got the underlying equities are the 20 stocks that are in the ASX 20. Okay. So in 2 years' time, one by one, you calculate what's their share price performance been in that two-year period. Okay. Then you add 10% to that. The reason we're adding 10% is just basically as a de facto for the fact that you're not getting dividends. So the 10% is basically, you can think of as, instead of dividends, you just add 10% to the price performance. Okay. And then stock by stock, if any of those have been more than 60%, then you only get a gain from that share of 60%. Anything less than 60%, you get its actual gain. And then you take the average of those, 20. And that's what determines the payoff at the end of 2 years. So in that sense, your payoff could be up to getting back 155% of your capital, plus 95% plus the maximum 60, or it could be as low as 95% of your capital. Okay. Here's examples that show what the payoff from this investment would have been. The way to interpret this graph is on the vertical axis, you've got the IRR realised from a two-year investment, finishing on the dates across the bottom. So the first one there with the date of August 2002, so that's if you made the investment in August 2000 and it finished in August 2002, your IRR would have been about zero for the red dotted line. The other lines I have up there is the ASX 200 total return, just so you can compare it to the sort of total equity market return. And then we've also put in just the price returns for both the ASX 200 and the ASX 20, so you can see how much of a risk there is if you're only using 20 stocks instead of 200. Basically, what you're getting is 95% capital protection. If you were just to buy the ASX 200, say, and take a 95% put option, it would cost you about 5% per annum. What you can see you get here is, towards the left-hand side of the graph, you get total returns that are sometimes better than ASX 200, but not much below, and definitely not 5% below. Yes, we haven't, there's two things. The actual return from the ASX 200 would be bumped up through dividend imputation. It would then be brought back down through the cost of capital you've got from holding equities. So I've just left both of them out. They're sort of roughly offsetting. On the right-hand side of the graph, the sort of structure is underperforming the sort of naked equity investment by more than 5%. So what you're basically doing is, instead of paying a fixed 5% per year of protection, you end up paying more for protection when the asset earns really well and less when it's not earning well. So it's really just a way of smoothing returns across that way. My thoughts are, if you can turn equities into such an investment, then instead of having, say, an investment account business, instead of having 20, 30% equities, you can have a lot larger proportion of this type of thing. Get the significant upside potential that's there, but not take on the downside risk that you would be taking on if you just had more equities. Here's my attempt at the capital implications. Obviously, everything needs to be confirmed with APRA. On the general insurance side, I don't know if we have anyone here from general insurance. Is it worth going through that in detail? Okay. I'll do it just for you. The new capital factor has gone to 16% for unprotected equities, probably 25% next year. We'll wait and see. But there's an interesting little thing in the standards which has special treatment for equity debt hybrid instruments. And it says you have to consult with APRA on those. And what APRA will tell you is that for the guaranteed portion, you can just present value as if it's just a note, that's just a plain fixed interest note, and the capital factor of the present value of the guaranteed portion is just the capital factor that from whoever supplies that guarantee. So in our case at Deutsche Bank, that's AA rated, so it's a 2% capital factor. For the rest of the present value of the note, that's what they call the derivative part. You've then got to flow through the derivative rules. Flowing through all that, you end up, in this particular example, with just under 5% capital factor. But you can actually achieve a much better result than that, which is if you wanted to invest in something like this, instead of actually doing $100 million investment, put your $100 million in cash and do this investment on swap, where you pay BBSW and you receive this asset, this return. Okay. What APRA have said that would mean is that the capital factor for this would then be 2% lower because you're not actually taking on, say, Deutsche Bank credit risk. You're not giving us the money. It would be 2% lower, offset by the fact that your cash would now have a 0.5% capital factor. So in total, you'd be at about 3.5%. Interestingly, I think that seems to work across most asset classes for general insurers. If you do it on swap and keep the cash, you basically bring the capital factors down. I have no idea why there's a basis risk component. It seems ludicrous to me. If anyone hears from APRA, then they can defend it. But there's a specific, they put the standards out in December. They put an update out in April, which had a little subparagraph 46C, I think, added, which said that it was talking about basis risk between if you've got a derivative position and you're hedging it, and how closely matched they are depends on how much capital you've got to hold for basis risk. And they added this little sentence that said something along the lines that for derivatives that aren't used for hedging, the basis risk charge is 8%. My question would be basis risk compared to what? You're not actually hedging anything. So I don't know why they've decided to put a basis risk charge in, but it's just one of those things. On the life insurance side, the benefit you get here, obviously, compared to straight equities is, I've just sort of roughly taken a 2% change in interest rates and a 25% fall in equities to approximate the resilience reserve. Obviously, the value of this doesn't go down 25% if equities go down 25%. So straight away, compared to holding naked equities, you've got a significant capital advantage. And then on top of that, if the position of the net position of that asset liability portfolio is one where a fall in rates hurts you, well, the bond component of this asset means that the fall in rates hurts it less. So compared to, say, straight equities, where you've got, say, 25% capital factor, you're looking here at less than 10. Okay. And that sort of supports what I was saying, that instead of holding, say, 30% equities, you can say 50% of something like this, and you give a lot bigger upside to the policyholders or investors, and at the same time reducing the risk of the insurer and reducing the amount of capital they have to hold. I just sort of touch on using the same concept, but if you actually like coupons instead, you might just look at the five-year one here, where it's the same concept of 20 shares and looking at the price performance and not taking the price performance of each one above a certain level. But in this example, the five-year one, we have a five-year note, so the capital at the end is 100% guaranteed. You have minimum coupons guaranteed along the way, and the particular stream we've got here is 94333. So you get a guaranteed minimum IRR of 4.5%. Your upside is capped at 15%, so you don't get more than 15% return from any particular share. But in calculating the coupons, the way you calculate them is you always look back at what's the price increase since the start of the note, not just in this 1 year. So just sort of as an unrealistic example that really highlights that, if all the shares went up 15% in the first year and then stayed dead flat, your coupons would be 15, 15, 15, 15, 15. So it's just another sort of variation, the same theme of different ways you can turn equities, say, into something which maybe fits better within your risk constraints and regulatory constraints. There's an example there of If you had of invested in that five-year note, 28th of February 2003, so finishing just 2 months ago, that's what it would have returned each year, a total IRR of about 13%. The other example I've got there is if, you know, for argument's sake, share prices just went up 4% per annum, so if you had have had a direct equity investment, assuming 4% dividends as well, and maybe, I don't know, 1% mutation on top of that, you would have got about 9% per year. Under this one, you get dividends of 9, 8, 12, and then 15, because of 15, you know, being reached. That's it on that particular equity idea. Has anyone got any questions on that? Feedback, do you think it's a stupid idea? Or? No? I did a session yesterday on alternative assets, and this page is just stolen from that one that just went over the benefits that are around from investing in various alternative assets, largely due to, you know, one or several of higher expected returns, lower volatility, and diversification or correlation benefits are basically the three benefits. A lot of the concerns or the reasons that people balk at alternative assets some of them have quite low liquidity, sort of private equity hedge funds being very good examples of that. Lack of transparency, again, you know, hedge funds basically charge 2% plus performance fees to earn an amount of money. It's not in their interest to tell you how they're doing it. So there is, you know, an inbuilt motive not to be transparent. That 2% plus performance fee, that covers the expensive issue. And also, you know, a lot of them are complex. We talked yesterday about using sort of beta access as a way to overcome those problems. But the question still remains, which alternative are you interested in investing in? And my experience in talking to insurers is, you know, they don't have people dedicated to that space, so it's very difficult to come up to the decision of, okay, do I want to have some commodity exposure or some currency exposure or a hedge fund? And if so, what commodity or what currency? You know, a lot of them saying, yes, you know, we think that alternative deserves a place in the asset portfolio, but you know, which ones and how to do it. So what I've put here is an example of a basket of alternatives where what goes into the asset mix is in the equity space, we've got long short equity. You've got a commodity exposure. FX, you've got different long-short currency investment strategies. The rates one is a yield curve shape-based investment strategy. And don't worry about the alternatives because that's not in this particular example. So that and cash are sort of the five asset classes that are chosen from here. There's daily liquidity to overcome the liquidity concern. The thing about getting liquidity alternatives, a lot of the underlying markets are actually very, very liquid. Currency is far more liquid than equities, for example. You know, if you're investing in commodity through futures, it's very, very liquid. It's only when people try and wrap them as managed funds and lock your money and do this that you start becoming, you know, illiquid. But a lot of the underlying building blocks are very liquid. Transparent, you know, you can look straight through and see what's the actual allocation to each of these asset classes on any particular day. There is optimized asset allocation in this, which is sort of solving the problem of tactical asset allocation between one from one to the other. I think it's on a quarterly basis that this looks back over sort of the last quarter, looks at the returns from the five asset classes, and uses it uses the Markovitch process to say, okay, given that historic data, what is the most efficient combination of these assets? We overlay that with volatility targeting, so saying we want an asset class which only has 4% volatility. Okay, the way we do that basically is just putting a fair amount into cash and the rest into those asset classes, but adjusting the cash and the asset class levels so that you're targeting 4% total volatility. And then sort of extreme event risk management, I suppose, in that if returns over sort of a 60 business day period have been less than minus 4%, it'll trigger an automatic reallocation of assets as opposed to the regular one that happens anyway. That's what that's done in Australian dollars, where I've just split the return up each year into the red part, which is the BBSW, and the yellow part, which is the excess return each year. And the April one there is up until April 28. Get that. So it's aiming, with very, very low volatility, it's aiming just to produce steady excess returns above bond rates that aren't really correlated to anything. Over that period, the equity correlation has been, I think, 1%, and the bond correlation 0. What does that mean what does it do to your capital requirements? It's quite surprisingly very good for general insurers, just because of the way they've written the standards. A lot of the exposures through derivatives, and they basically said, we didn't consider investments like this. Having said that, they said, look, insurers are a pretty clever bunch. We don't expect them to allocate massive amounts of money to something like this, so as long as they don't go over the top, we don't have any plans to change the standards. So basically, anything that's an other asset in general insurance is going to be hit with 20% unless you can look through to the underlying assets. And that's exactly what you can do here, and look through to what's the charge for interest rate derivatives and equities derivatives, etc. On the life and health insurers, it's not as easy because it depends on every single company and their position. But I'm pretty sure the standard shocks aren't going to have any impact at all. So then it just comes down to what the appointed actuary would allocate as a 95% VAR level for this particular asset. I'm not an appointed actuary. If I was, I'm not going to say what I'd do if I was. But, I'd be pretty confident that there isn't that much risk in this. Having said that, if you actually want to be very sure, there's two things about this particular investment that make it very, very cheap to incorporate protection. One thing is that it's got low volatility. The other one is that when you get sort of to option pricing and you move into sort of risk-neutral models, the expected value of this asset in 1 year's time is very close to its value today, because a lot of the sort of long-short strategies in a risk-free world aren't expected to grow. So it means if you're buying sort of a call option in 1 year's time, compared to an equity call option where you expect $100 of equities to be, about $108 in a year's time. So therefore, if you're buying a call option struck at $100, you expect it to be $8 in the money. For this, you don't. You expect $100 now to be close to $100 in a year's time. So it makes the option a lot cheaper. This underlying product is either in euro or US dollars. Those returns there, the way I've done them is a feature which you can either pay to hedge out the currency risk, but then you're paying for hedging. Instead of come up with a way which removes most of the currency risk but doesn't actually cost you anything. And the way we do it is to, let's say you have a $100 million investment. You just hold that in whatever you want to hold it in and do this as a swap on $100 million. On day one, you say, okay, $100 million gives me how many euro? It's, say, 70. It's 70 million euro. So my swap notional is 70 million euro. At the end of the month, you actually say, what has the return been? And we basically pay you the yellow part at the end of each month. So, yes, there is currency risk to the extent that that yellow part's calculated in euro, and at the end of the month, we're going to swap it back into Aussie dollars. So the return you earn in that 1 month is at risk to currency movements for that 1 month. But at the end of the month, because it's got daily liquidity and it's only a notional investment size, all you can do is rebalance the notional size to be whatever euro is now 100 million Aussie dollars and just do it again and again. So the currency risk is very, very small. Getting back to sort of the implications of cheap protection, what you can actually get is a 1-year bond that's 100% capital guaranteed, and the payoff, the coupon at the end of 1 year, is 2 times those yellow bits. Okay, and that's, you know, then as an appointed actuary, you surely can't say that it's going to lose money. And that's just a, you know, drives from the fact that, you know, the protection is quite cheap. Okay, the financing side. The idea I've got here is, let's say you're raising hybrid capital or just plain old debt, is to buy a call option on an investment strategy, something like the previous one would have worked well. This particular example instead just has on fund of hedge funds. So you're paying for a call option. That's added to your interest cost. But then obviously the return from the call option is deducted from the interest cost. So your interest cost ends up being your normal rate of interest plus the cost of the call option minus the payout from the call option. So what that does is it decreases the expected cost of interest and puts a cap on the maximum total cost. There are other things you can do to, you know, that get a bit more complicated to provide even more protection on the sort of the downside. But as a simple example, this is a simple example of that strategy, whereby this has been set up as a 5-year debt instrument, whereby in year one the interest is your normal, you know, I've got here normal cost, you know, if it's straight debt it's just your debt cost, if it's hybrid debt it's your hybrid debt cost, but, you know, normal cost minus 1%. The reason that's done is just to give the underlying strategies time to perform, so you're not measuring after 1 year. So first year guaranteed 1% cheaper. For the other 4 years, the interest you pay is your normal cost plus 2.5% minus the return from the investment strategy. We've then got an example of what would have happened if you had have done this in July 2002. Assuming that your normal interest cost is 7%, your first year interest payment would have been 6%. Second year, you wouldn't have had any interest payment. And thereafter, sort of, around about 1-2%. I mean, that's just that's one scenario. But to give you an idea, what I've called break even is as long as the underlying fund of hedge funds returns are only 30% of the average they've returned historically, then the fund of hedge fund performance will cancel out the cost of the call option and you'll be left with just your straight normal interest cost. If, on the other hand, you say that the hedge funds or fund of hedge funds perform exactly as per the historical averages, then you're going to have an interest saving of about 3.7% per annum. This is just the last thing I was going to cover, which is around strategic asset allocation. It often focuses on sort of drawing efficient frontiers and looking at risk-return trade-offs. From my point of view, that often comes to suboptimal results because it's not considering a broad enough range of assets or different risk premium, and especially for insurers because it's also usually not considering the regulatory constraints that they invest within. I think a better approach is to understand those constraints, consider how a wide range of different risk premium can be put together within those constraints, with the aim of achieving sort of a maximum expected return within your regulatory constraints and risk appetite. And I've got one example here of how you might look at, say, an investment account portfolio. Firstly, sort of the way we think about things is to identify all the risks separately and then one by one say, does it make sense to actually hedge this risk? Is it cost effective to hedge this risk? Let's choose inflation as an example. Ask a few questions here. Let's just imagine that you're managing a book of disability income, inflation-linked disability income insurance. and you've got a large pool of long-term disabled lives that you're expecting to make payments on for, you know, the next 30, 40 years, and they're all inflation-linked. You can actually, in the swap market, enter a swap where you pay a fixed amount and you receive inflation. So I want you to stop and think now, we're going to get interactive. How much would you be willing to pay to take yourself out of that inflation risk? Okay. Let's put hands up if you'd be willing to pay 2%. Thanks. Only two people, three people. Everyone else thinks inflation over the long term is going to be below 2%. Wow, that surprises me. Okay. Current prices are about 4.1%. Pardon?
I'm going to say that I can halve that trade. Go back and sell it for a lot more than 2%. So I'll take
it. Yeah. Current prices are about 4. And you get to the level where most people think that 4 is too expensive and aren't willing to pay it. But I think you need to realise that if you are making that decision and saying, for my disability income book, I'm not going to hedge my inflation because the cost is 4%. So therefore, in effect, what I am choosing to do is I'm going to choose to take the other side of the hedge. I'm choosing to receive 4% and pay inflation because that's what I'm doing. I'm paying inflation to my policyholders and I'm receiving 4%, you know, due to the fact that of, say, my bond return, I'm keeping all of it, not giving 4% away. Now, if you think that that is the sensible thing to do for the disability income business, why not other businesses as well? Why not, as an investment strategy, would you not choose to pay away inflation and receive 4.1%? The only thing I could think of is that you wouldn't do that is if you think that the inflation risk associated with the disability income book is exactly the right amount of inflation risk that fits your risk appetite, which I don't think is very likely to happen. Any thoughts on that? You would have made an assumption in your pricing, and...
But why I'm raising it, Zach, is because that then affects whatever assumption you would have put in there, seems to me, would drive your reaction to a 2 or a 4 or a 5% option to get out of it.
Yeah, if you think that if you've assumed 3% in your pricing, then paying 4% to remove that risk is probably not an attractive thing.
Yeah, exactly.
So why not receive 4% to increase that risk?
The other
side of the deal. If you think inflation's only going to be 3, and what I'm saying is that is what you're doing. Like, you think, oh, that's risky, that's just taking a bet. That is what you're doing.
But you're describing a swap market here.
Yep. That's what a swap market is.
Question is, how much capital are you holding against that risk?
Yeah.
It's a 3% assumption, how much capital are you holding against that risk as well? That's
That's
where the margins come.
Yeah. And so I would say, that those are the type of things you need to examine. And I would be quite surprised if, when you looked at how much capital you're holding and your risk appetite, that you came up with an answer that says, here's how much inflation risk fits within our appetite. Oh, and guess what? It's exactly the amount we already have. And so I would be surprised if you didn't, if you went through that process, you didn't decide, actually, we want to either increase or decrease our inflation risk. We'll have to take that offline. We can do over about $1 billion worth of long-term inflation. And the thing you can do with an inflation swap is actually you can structure it, because there's always index-linked bonds as an alternative. Comparing the two, there's not many government index-linked bonds left. So if you're forced to go outside the government bonds, then you're taking on credit risk. And the people who issue index-linked bonds don't necessarily have the highest sort of credit ratings around. So that's sort of one advantage of the swap market versus index-linked bonds. Another advantage, I would say, is that you can actually design an inflation swap around your exact liability profile strength, with the amounts in the years that you want, linked to CPI with a six-month lag. If that's the way your liabilities do it, you can do exact matching of your liability strength. Anyway, that was enough on inflation. It's only one bullet point. we're meant to be talking about investment account, and what I would say here is, you know, the approach, you know, what seems to me a sensible approach is to, once you've gone through and removed, you know, worked out which risks are cheaper to hedge and remove them, then you say, okay, this is my risk appetite that's left, so I'm going to sort of fill that up by taking on different asset risks. Typically, investment account business tends to be about 70% bonds, 30% equities, and that's basically because that 30% of equities fills up the risk appetite. You know, you can't afford to have negative or prolonged negative returns, and most people tend to stop at sort of 30 to 40% equities. I'd put it to you that as an investor, a long-term investor, that's not a pretty good investment. And it's not driven by what gives the policyholder the best investment return. It's largely driven by what gives the insurer the least amount of capital requirement and the least amount of risk. I put up there just as an example, as an alternative, using that sort of structured equity we were talking about earlier, the two-year version. Let's say you've got a $1 billion portfolio. Instead of having 700 million bonds and 300 million equities, you could have 20 million bonds. We just say two-year bonds there in that example, yielding 7.5%. Sorry, 200 million bonds, 600 million of the structured equity. What that means between the two of them is that you've got the capital guarantee between the two. Because at most, you can lose 5% on the equities, 5% of 600 million being $30 million. And the minimum you're going to get, well, what you'll get back on the bonds is $30 million. You know, 7.5% on 300 million. Sorry, on 200 million for 2 years. So the two of them combined basically give you a capital protected position. I mean, that can be achieved just through the structured equity, just through, you know, changing the 95% guarantee to 100% and reducing the upside exposure. I think the 60% upside's got to come down to about 40% in that case. And then adding into that, say a 20% allocation to the 1 year capital guaranteed note that's linked to that alternative investment strategy we hit up there. So again, over a 2 year period, you cannot lose money, you know, apart from, I suppose, credit default risk. You know, to the extent that you believe in equities, then the policy, and you must believe in equities as a risk premium in this case, because that's what you had before, 30% equities, 70% bonds. So to the extent you believe in equities, you're giving policyholders much greater upside on equities. They've got a similar expected return, much greater upside. If equities do underperform, then the alternatives aren't expected to. So you've sort of got your diversification benefit there. And you've put the insurer in a much better capital position as well, and much lower risk position. And then I would say once you've gone through that process, the last step then is to look at, okay, what's your duration mismatch? Is there anything else there that you can just balance up in sort of the interest rate swap market? So sort of in summary, what I've been trying to say is that in certain cases, transferring risk to markets can add value. You maybe need to think outside the square a bit, but there's a lot there that can be done. Those type of strategies can be implemented either on the asset side or managing your liabilities or on the financing side as well. And I think your strategic asset allocation should consider these type of things. Like, I think those things don't fit in our model isn't really a valid excuse. And I actually think it's, you know, if the appointed actuary isn't considering things like that, they're not fulfilling their duty of looking after policyholders' interests. Because that, as a policyholder, to me, that gives me a better expected return. And it also has the added benefit of giving the insurer a sort of lower risk position as well. That's sort of all I had to say. I was hoping to hear thoughts on whether you just think I'm smoking crack or something, or... or whether...
just a quick reminder, if you are going to ask a question, please do come up and grab the mic up here on the chair next to the projector.
Everyone's in complete agreement. Fantastic.
Hi, Jeff Ferguson. I'm a director of a corporate super fund, so we're always looking for good ideas on how we can manage our defined benefit risk better or make a little bit of extra money. So I came in here today to, I guess, get my eyes open to the opportunities that are out there, and not that I understood half of what you were talking about today. So there's a big learning I need to take myself through. I guess some practical questions from my perspective. These are over-the-counter or privately negotiated contracts. So in a practical sense, you've got proprietary models, no doubt, to work out what you think's fair value for these sophisticated structures, and then the purchaser probably needs their own sophisticated models to work out what they think's fair value. In your practical experience, how far apart do parties start of when they're thinking through what's the right price for these type of structured contracts? That's what question one. And question two, and I've just come from a unit pricing session before this about errors and restitution, and the more complicated products become, the more complex unit pricing becomes and the work for custodians. And I'm just wondering, you know, would these kind of products work where we're trying to do daylight unit pricing? So there might be a really good investment criteria here, but it's not going to work for a super fund doing daily pricing unless we can get prices every day that are reliable and not subject to error.
I'll answer the second one first. Something like that's got a Bloomberg code. It's got a daily price up there. Around the structured equity type things, they don't have Bloomberg codes, but we can provide daily market values. Already sort of for anyone who buys these, they need at a minimum monthly values to put in their accounts anyway, so we're already doing that. So then that sort of answers the second part. So the first part then is, okay, how do we calculate those values? We can have an open formula. Here's the formula, is how it's calculated. And so the question really just comes into what assumptions are going into that. And with the equity one, the main one being the correlation assumption. The reason you can get such a high cap compared to a floor is because the floor is calculated across all shares and the cap is calculated one by one. So what you're actually doing is you're selling individual options on all the shares at the top end, and you're buying less than that amount at the bottom end. And how much less you buy depends on your correlation assumption. It's interesting that one reason that works so well at the moment is because you've got high volatility, and because you're selling more options than you're buying, you're getting the volatility of the markets to work for you. Okay. So the formulas are quite simple in terms of how they're calculated. The assumptions are the main thing.
So when you start a buyer and seller, how far apart do you start your funding negotiations before you find what's the spread before you come to a mutual agreement as to price?
Yeah, no, it tends to be, this is the price, that's the price. And while these things sound quite complicated, a lot of banks do similar things, and there is a fair bit of price competition there. That's the price. You tend to have, the market value we give will have sort of a 1% bid offer spread. So that's the best estimate. But if you want to sell out of it early, it's 1% less. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Paul Ifey. Might only like to ask a couple of questions about the existing market environment. Mm-hmm. Both on the demand side, my guess most life insurers have been fairly well capitalised recently. So do you find that that has much of an impact, or would you expect that that's had much of an impact on the appetite for this type of product up until now? And also over on the, over on the markets side, there's been a lot of turmoil over in the investment markets. Do you find that all these products are available still? And do you find that the drying up of liquidity in the markets has had any sort of impact on either the availability of the products or the ability to enter in and out of them on a on a daily or weekly, monthly type of basis?
Okay. On the market side, we haven't had any drying up of liquidity in anything here. To use this as an example, those sort of four or five underlying investments, they are all separate. You know, this was put together recently based around investment indices that are so have their own Bloomberg codes in their own right, and each of those has over $1 billion invested in it, some of them close to $20 billion. So there's quite large investments in those, and you know, we haven't seen any sort of drying up in that market at all. I've got to remember the first question. The demand and the lazy capital argument. It's true, it's particularly for investment account business where if it's participating, people say, well, you know, it's shareholders' funds there anyway, and it's, you know, we've got to share 80% of it or something, so it's not really that big a cost of capital. That's sort of been the biggest pushback, I suppose, the biggest argument in support of inertia is that, you know, the cost of capital on that investment account business, if it's participating, isn't actually that high anyway. But then sort of, you know, my answer to that would be forget about cost of capital. You're decreasing your risk and giving the policyholder a higher expected return. What's the problem?
Actually, Zach, just while you're on that slide, it's sort of, you know, a couple of the plenary speakers have made the comment that, you know, if it looks too good to be true, it probably is. So this looks pretty good. What are the problems with it? What are the costs? And where do you do worse than, say, a 70% bond, 30% equity strategy?
You do worse if, you know, equity market rallies, you know, 50% a year. And so over 2 years, you would have had an IRR of 50%, but you only get an IRR of, well, in this case, it ended up being about 23%. So it's extreme bull markets is where you'll definitely do worse. You know, extreme markets the other way, you're definitely going to do better because you've got your capital protection. They meet somewhere in between. And sort of in between, whether you do better or worse is going to depend on not just the total level of the equity markets, but the actual shares. You know, if some of them go through the roof and others go way down, then you're going to be worse off because the ones that go through the roof, you're capping your return, you're getting all the negative from the downs. Yeah. But as long as, and that's why sort of potentially shorter versions of this, you know, a two-year thing might be more attractive than a five-year in that sense because there's less chance of things going way through the roof. That's basically where you miss out if things go through the cap. If it looks too good to be true, I would say don't throw it out. I'd say investigate it. Don't dismiss it offhand until you actually know it is too good to be true.
Any other questions? We've got another couple of minutes.
They are more difficult to model, I suppose. I think it's only because we're used to modelling equities. If you're actually modelling the equity market, you're actually modelling what you predict the fortunes of 200 different companies to be. So some would argue if you tried to do that from first principles, that's not an easy thing either. They are more difficult to model. That's why we have smart asset consultants to do the modelling. We model them internally because we actually have to manage the risk on these, and we have our own internal ALM models which we're happy to let people use over the web, and they have our assumptions in them. Now, you can overwrite that with your own assumptions, and we're not saying they're the right assumptions, but they're the ones we use to manage our risk, so that there's been a fair bit of work go into them. In terms of liquidity, it really, really depends on, you know, the problem with alternatives is people say alternatives and think, oh, it's one type of thing. You know, it can be anything from, you know, a currency position, which has far, far more liquidity than, say, an equity market, all the way down to a hedge fund, which, yeah, it could dry up liquidity in one day. So it really depends on, you know, don't just think alternatives, think which one. Okay. Okay, if there's no more, I'll tell Anton to hurry up.
Okay, we'll probably wrap it up there. Thanks, everyone, for coming on, for your questions, and let's thank Zach for his presentation.
Thanks.